Good morning. It's good to be back in Iowa. Thank you for the folks here in Iowa State for hosting me today, for the students who are here, and for the ones who are out in the hallway. I hope you can hear me as well. As governor of New Jersey, you know, over the years, I've gotten to visit a lot of interesting places and gotten to meet a lot of extraordinary people. But there are some places that are really special to me. And some of the most special places that I've gotten to visit are the places I'm visiting today, college campuses across the country. So the way I see it, every place of learning is a chance to actually see our future, to visualize our future. Here at Iowa State, we get to see the future of agriculture, of engineering, of science, of communications, and so many other fields where Iowa State is leading the way. We get to see the future of leadership, amazing students like the one sitting behind me, faculty who will define our country's path in the years ahead. And we get to see young people choosing their own futures, getting the skills and knowledge to go out into the world and achieve new opportunities for themselves and for their families and for the communities from where they come and to where they're headed. Every great university is a monument. It's a monument to America's faith in our future. Every quality school is a ladder. It's a ladder that helps us to reach higher in the future that we want to achieve. And every hardworking student and every hardworking teacher is leading us into that future. There's no greater cause for hope or no greater force for change in our country than education. When we get education right, that's when we can get more people climbing that ladder as individuals throughout this country. But education is also how we climb that ladder as a country. Think about everything in the last 100 years that defined the American century. We built an economy without equal in the world. We won wars and we kept the peace. We led the world in new discoveries and in innovation, exploring wonders from the inside of an atom to the surfaces of other worlds. Every single one of those achievements began with education. It began with the hunger of a student, the patience and the wisdom of a teacher. The race for the stars began at a classroom desk. Think about it. It started at a classroom desk when we trained a new generation of engineers who listened to President Kennedy's call and built the Apollo program in a decade. It was scientists at the Ames Laboratory who helped lead the Manhattan Project, delivering the weapons to end one world war and deter another. And it was Iowa State that helped usher in a new digital age with the invention of the first electronic digital computer, which was done right here, as you know, on this campus. So when we talk about how to continue improving education in our country, for me, that's a debate that's full of hope. And it's something I'm looking forward to talking about with all of you today. I know this is a really important issue for Americans everywhere. And in every community I visit, whether it's in my home state of New Jersey or in the states I've been visiting around the country, people want to talk about education. They have lots of ideas and a lot of concerns about it too. So this is something we need to have a conversation about as a country, in my opinion. Here's the interesting, though, about the education debate. Everyone, you won't find anyone who doesn't agree, everyone agrees that education is essential to our country's future. But at the national level, almost no one is having a productive conversation about education. When reformers talk about how we can improve the quality of teaching in our schools or hold teachers more accountable for the performance of their students, they're shouted down by the unions for being anti-teacher. When people talk about how to give parents greater choice over the way their children are educated, or ways to introduce greater innovation into public schools that have been teaching the same way for two centuries, they're condemned as enemies of public education. And when it comes to giving more young people a chance to participate in higher education without absorbing mountains of debt, or to improving the quality of teaching and research in our universities, it's called by the establishment outrageously disruptive to time-tested institutions. Now, I don't think that this approach serves our country well, and I don't think it's worthy of anyone who wants to be the leader in our country. Because right now, there are lots of signs that we're starting to fall behind in education when you compare us to the rest of the world. In the most recent OECD rankings, out of 34 countries, the United States is 27th out of 34 in math and 20th in science when it comes to measuring standards of achievement for 15-year-olds. So think about that again now. 27th in math, 20th in science out of 34. In 1995, we had some of the highest college graduation rates among the major industrialized economies. Now, we're somewhere near the bottom. In a survey of American scientists done recently, just 16% of American scientists say that our K-12 education system is above average or better when it comes to teaching our kids the things they need to know about science. Among American CEOs and business leaders, 97% say their company faces a skills gap in the United States, finding it difficult to get qualified candidates to fill the roles they need to grow their businesses. But even all that data, as sobering as it is, doesn't tell the full story. It doesn't tell us the human cost of a broken education system as well. Think about the bright young kid who wants to do well in school, but is being punished by a public education system because they were born into the wrong zip code and a failing school district. It's no fault of their own. Think about the mother and father who are desperately trying to make ends meet so that their child can be the first in their family to earn a college degree, and feeling like they have to choose between what they're doing to raise their families every day and mountains of debt. Heroic educators who want to do what's right for their students and put them first, but when they do, they get smothered by the bureaucracy and the defenders of the status quo in the education establishment. Well, if we want education to remain a force for change in our country, then we need to do better, and we need to have a real and honest discussion about the education reforms we need, where we can acknowledge the challenges we face without wallowing in the pessimism that many folks inject into this conversation. We owe it to our students, we owe it to the parents, we owe it to the teachers, we owe it to the communities that pay for this education, and we owe it to our country. Because if we don't fix education, we hurt the quality of life for all of us. We don't get to climb the ladder of progress as a nation. We don't get to aim for the stars in the 21st century. So it's time we had a conversation about education that isn't defined by ideological dogma or by narrow personal institutional interests. So let's talk about what real education reform for America looks like, and let's talk about it today. So first, let's start by talking about how we can improve our public school system in this country. Now, every school district has its own challenges, but we also know that in K-12 education, we face some common challenges in every community. We need to ensure that every child receives a quality education, no matter where they live. We need to reward good teachers and demand accountability in the classrooms for results. And we need to acknowledge that not all children face the same circumstances, and their parents deserve to choose the best way to be able to educate them. When I took office as governor of New Jersey at the beginning of 2010, I inherited a situation where we had to face all of those challenges, and in some cases, some pretty extreme versions of them. Start with this. New Jersey was spending more per pupil in our public schools than almost any other state in America. But in many cases, children weren't receiving the education they deserved. While many public schools were succeeding, others were failing, and often the great successes we had in some of our other districts were used to camouflage the failure we had in the districts where things were going poorly. While the vast majority of our public school teachers were performing well, some were underperforming significantly, and they were holding back their school districts. And administrators were powerless to take action because they were guaranteed a job for life after 3 years because of the tenure laws in our state and around the country. And in some communities, education had become an intractable problem for generation after generation. Think about this. In Newark, New Jersey's largest city, we spend $26,000 per pupil per year. $26,000 per pupil per year. And just one in four ninth graders entering high school were going to finish high school 4 years later. in the city of Asbury Park, which many of you may recall from Bruce Springsteen making it famous, we were spending nearly $30,000 per pupil. But the dropout rate in Asbury Park was almost 10 times the state average. Now, lots of people said we couldn't fix it, or that we should just try to throw more money at it. The pessimists, led by the teachers union, declared that unless you have a PhD in education, you really don't get it. You can't understand. Your solutions are too simplistic, that they were smarter than our elected leaders and the parents who were making these decisions as well. Their view, more money was the only real solution. They claimed that those of us who acknowledged our failures didn't respect the work of teachers. We know that's ridiculous. It wasn't that reformers were ignoring the interests of teachers. It was teachers' unions who were ignoring their own members. The majority of these heroic, tireless educators who just want to do the best for their students, that's what motivates teachers to get into the profession in the first place. But their union puts the comfort of adults ahead of the potential of children. When the union said that only more money could reform K-12 education, here's what I said to them. It's not it. We need accountability, we need competition, and we need choice. That's what will put our children first. See, I'm a product of the public school system in New Jersey. I wouldn't be standing here if it weren't for the wonderful teachers and the great school system that prepared me for college and for law school. And then all the things that I had to confront intellectually and professionally over the rest of my life. So not taking on the challenge to make public education better was simply not an option for me, given that everything I had achieved from an intellectual perspective was a product of our public education system. So here's what I decided to do. In a bipartisan effort, Republicans and Democrats in the state legislature came together with my administration, with teachers and principals and school administrators, and with education experts to build support for comprehensive education reform and then to enact it. For the first time in 100 years, we came together to reform teacher tenure in New Jersey. Stop here for a second to let you know that the teacher tenure system at the K-12 level started in New Jersey. It's the oldest teacher tenure law in America, so you have us to thank for it. I'll accept the thank you notes on the way out. So imagine that for the state that started all this, we had not touched that statute in 100 years. Imagine a statute that a legislature hasn't touched in 100 years. You get paid not to touch it, everybody. That's why it doesn't get touched. So failing teachers now in New Jersey can be removed from the classroom and held accountable for the performance of their students. 1 year of a failing evaluation or 2 years of a below average evaluation and tenure can be removed in New Jersey now from a teacher. See, because I believe that there's no other profession in the country where if you're failing and you're hurting the interests of the people you're supposed to serve, that you can get away with it without any repercussions. There's no other profession where we stand for that kind of conduct. So to put children first, reforming teacher tenure is a first and reasonable step in the right direction across the entire country. Through some real hard-nosed collective bargaining, we then, for the first time, were able to bring merit pay for teachers to schools in Newark, New Jersey. More than two decades of research have shown that the two factors used to calculate a teacher's salary, educational credentials and time served, aren't actually related to a teacher's effectiveness in the classroom. So we've now changed that system in Newark, one of our most failing school districts, so that now we can pay the best teachers more and reflect actual results. In every other aspect of American society, we reward achievement, we reward accomplishment, we pay more for excellence, and it seems to work pretty well for us. So again, doing this not only is common sense, but it's another reasonable step forward to try to change our system. We also opened up New Jersey's public school choice program to any interested school district, giving parents greater choice over where to send their children. This is a program driven by a simple principle that I think parents are better suited to make decisions about their children's education than union leaders. This upcoming year, nearly 5,000 students in New Jersey will attend schools outside their hometown, and about 132 school districts are participating in that program. So it seems to me, it looks like parents agree, they're the better ones to choose where their children should be educated. We've also helped to expand quality charter schools across New Jersey, adding 35 new charter schools over the past 5 years, but also closing 17 charter schools that weren't performing well. We now have 87 charter schools across our state, and more than 37,000 students are enrolled in our charter schools, and thousands are waiting on waiting lists for us to open even more of them, especially in our failing school districts. And over the last 4 years, we've invested a record amount in aid to our public schools, nearly $12 billion in state aid in the current fiscal year. Money on its own won't get the job done, but if we do combine that with the kind of meaningful reforms that I've talked about and will continue to talk about, we can use taxpayer money more responsibly in a way that really makes a difference. As part of that, we made sure that we're investing in better leaders and administration in our schools with our principals and our superintendents, because you can't have a good school without a good leader. Think about this. When I came into office, 70% of the school superintendents in New Jersey were being paid more than the governor. A pretty good gig. That just seemed crazy to me. So we've changed that system to ensure that we're not blowing tons of money on bureaucracy and that bonuses for administrators are based on objectively measured performance of the students in their district and not that their school board just seems to like them more. Of course, there are plenty of things we still need to fix in New Jersey. In Camden, in Newark, in Paterson, and other of our major cities, we need to continue working hard to turn around failing schools. But we've already started to make progress because of the steps that I just talked about. We've also challenged the antiquated rule around who gets laid off when budgets get cut. We've always had a system across this country called last in, first out, which means if you're the teacher who joined the school most recently, even if you're the highest performing teacher in the district, you're the person who gets laid off first. Does this make any sense to any of you? I mean, it makes no sense at all to me, but the power of the teachers union has prevented us from instituting quality-based layoffs. It's insane, but it's the worst policy that money can buy, right? And it's been bought by the unions to protect their most ineffective members. So getting rid of last in, first out should be a national priority. Layoffs should be done based on quality, not based upon how many years you served or when you signed your contract. We've grown the number of charter schools. We passed something called the Urban Hope Act to create renaissance schools in our highest risk dual school districts, and children and their families are flocking to them. We've brought in transformative leaders and we've started new programs, and none of this we've done on our own. We've worked with the teachers in those communities. We've listened to community leaders and parents to get their buy-in, and we brought in new expertise and new talent from around the country. And if our goal is to provide a quality education for every child, no matter where they live, sometimes that means giving communities new options to deal with unique circumstances, and that's what we did. Education at the K-12 level can be fixed in this country, and there are great people on both sides of the political aisle and wonderful teachers who are willing to do the right thing. Now, none of this was easy, and in fact, it was really hard to pull people together when we faced so much opposition. But we must keep going. We cannot turn back. And we cannot back down. And we in New Jersey refuse to take no for an answer. We must put the God-given potential of every child first. I'll end with this on this section of it. A few years ago, right after I got elected governor, I got a letter from a woman living in Texas who on the return address, I didn't recognize her last name. I opened it up, and this is in essence what it said. Dear Governor-elect Christie, I saw you on CNN this week, and you look just like the dark-haired young man who entered my fifth-grade classroom 37 years ago. I challenged you back then, and you answered that challenge. I hope you remember me, because I sure remember you, and I wanted you to know I'm proud of you. She had remarried, so I didn't recognize her last name, but that was my fifth-grade teacher. It's my fifth-grade teacher, Ruth Manishin. And you know, I remember her so well because from K to four, I got all A's. And I went into my fifth grade class feeling pretty good about myself. And I wrote my first essay for Mrs. Manishin. And I got it back, and it was a C. So you'll be surprised to know, knowing me a little bit, that after school I went up to her desk. And I said, like, this has got to be a mistake. I've never gotten a C. And she said, well, Mr. Christie, I don't know what you've been handing in before and what grades you've been getting, but you can do much better than this. And if you expect to get A's in my class, you're going to get to work. You bet I remember her. And she remembered me 37 years later watching on television. Think about all the students she taught over her career. That story is really special for me because it's really not about me. It's about her. It's about how valuable each of her students was to her. That's what teachers do when they're at their best. They're memorable. We all remember them. Everybody in this audience, young or old, has a teacher in your mind that you remember that affected your life. They change lives. The enemy we face is not teachers. It's the mediocrity of inaction. The people who would rather not speak up to fix a broken system because it's too hard to speak up. Or those who'd rather just shout down people with reasonable, nonpartisan solutions because they want to advance selfish interests. We've successfully fought a lot of that in New Jersey to get tenure reform and to get merit pay, to get public school choice, to get more charter schools. But we've lost fights too. Last in, first out still exists in New Jersey, as do some failing school districts. The fight's had some successes, but the fight is far from over. And I believe in this country we need a president who will fight for parents and their children, to put them in control of their education, and not the unions and the education establishment, who is, by the way, in control of it today in our country. Let's put children's interests before special interests. Let's demand that every child in this country gets a great education. Now, after high school comes higher education, and improving higher education is the other half of the education reform our country needs. And particularly appropriate to discuss that standing here at Iowa State. So let's be clear. Higher education is an opportunity that every person in our country should have access to, because the consequences of getting it can be totally life-changing. I want to share a story with you about my father, Bill Christie, who's now 82 years old. My dad was an outstanding high school student. He was at the very top of his class, and he seemed destined for greater things. And then my grandfather passed away when he was a sophomore in high school. Changed his entire family, as you can imagine. And this is now back in the late 1940s. He was such a good student. In fact, he got an offer of admission from Columbia University. But my dad couldn't go. His father had died. They couldn't afford it. And you can imagine how incredibly disappointed he was. He would have been the first in his family to go to college. My dad ended up then being drafted into the Army during the Korean War. And after he got back, he wasn't sure what he wanted to do with the rest of his life. So he wound up taking a job at the Breyers Ice Cream Plant in Newark, New Jersey. At this point in the story, my dad's life could have gone in an entirely different direction. He could have worked on that production line for as long as that plant remained open. But there was an older man on that line who took a shine to my dad. And he took it upon himself to, as my father told me, pester him. Pester my father with advice. He said, say to him, you're a smart young man. You fought in the Army for our country. Why did you go to college on the GI Bill? My father was still not happy from not being able to go to Columbia. He wasn't sure if he really was college material anymore and wasn't sure if he should take this colleague's advice. So he decided to dip his toe in. He went to Rutgers in Newark and signed up for classes at night while he continued to work at the Breyers Ice Cream Plant. Because he said it was a good job. He got to walk to work. He said the pay was pretty good, and he got free ice cream. That wasn't bad. So he went to Rutgers at night and decided to study accounting. And 6 years later, while working all day and going to school at night, 6 years later, he had what my mother called our first family picture. My dad on his graduation day of June of 1962, with his cap and gown on, my mother standing next to him, with her being 6 months pregnant with me. It was an incredibly proud day for both of them. He continued to work to pay his way through college, had help from the GI Bill, and it changed his life. So because my dad was helped by that colleague who pestered him, and by the country through the GI Bill for the country he served, he was able to get his degree in accounting. He ended up becoming a certified public accountant and having a career in accounting and on Wall Street for 40 years after that time. It's because he had the determination, sure, but it's also because he had the support. My mother, the GI Bill, he was able to change his life, and he was able to lift our family up. He was the only one, by the way, he had three other siblings. He was the only one of them that went to college. And one generation later, his oldest child, the one who was in the womb when he got his degree, has become a two-term governor of the state where he was born and raised. That's the reason I'm here talking with all of you about this. I wouldn't be here having this chance if it wasn't for what he did and the opportunities that were presented to him that he took advantage of. So that's a personal story to me, but it's also the story of how our system is really supposed to work. A system where all we need is to take personal responsibility, to grasp the opportunities of higher education. But it's also a story of one where if you can get a leg up when you need it, it'll make a huge difference in your life. It's a story about what a college education can mean to change a life. Today, we know that story is also backed up by data, right? By absolutely independent data. From research, we know there's no other time in history when going to college is more closely tied to economic mobility. In the United States, people with a college degree on average are paid more than 74% more than those with just a high school diploma. And for almost every parent and every family, a college education is something they strive to achieve for their children. 94% of parents in a recent poll say they want their children to go to college. Well, I think that's a good thing, and we should celebrate it, and we should encourage every young person with the drive to go to college. Republicans have always believed that the future belongs to those who are willing to work the hardest and are the most ambitious Americans. We should celebrate and support every young person who dreams of bettering themselves through higher education. And as for our state and federal governments, their role should be clear too. They need to make it easier for every student to get a higher education and to support them in reaching their full potential through affordable, quality programs. So how do we achieve it? Part of the solution will be through the steps we've taken to improve the K-12 education system, for certain. If we can improve the quality of the learning experience in our high schools, if we can reduce the number of high school graduates who need remedial training before taking a college class, more young people will be motivated and be prepared to go on for higher education. If we improve one part of our system, we can improve all of it. States should offer early intervention programs to ensure college readiness. New Jersey, this is something we're already doing. We launched a pilot program, College Readiness Now, that offers low-income students the chance to take remediation classes early in their high school careers, before they ever enroll in college, allowing students to close achievement gaps that can hold them back later in their college careers. Community colleges across New Jersey have been working with over 60 high schools to help high school juniors and seniors to improve their English and math skills. We've been running this since last year with the support of state-administered federal funding, and more than 900 students have already been through spring and summer transition programs offered by community colleges. After completing the program, all the students showed progress, and half of the students were ready for college with no further training. It's something we're really encouraged about, and we think it can be a great model for other states and for the country. But getting high school students ready for college is only part of the solution. To help more students into higher education, we need to solve some of the bigger challenges that face our country. The first of these is making college more affordable. Now, the affordability of higher education has been a big challenge for a long time, but since the economic downturn in 2008, this has become an even bigger issue for parents and students in our country. And it's having a severe impact on all of those families. Over the last few years, tuition rates have gone through the roof. They've been steadily climbing since the 1980s, but over the last decade, they've exploded at public four-year colleges. Grants and financial assistance from the states have helped a bit, but they haven't kept pace with the costs. Students are having to take two or three or more jobs just to get by, making it difficult for them to focus on their studies and completing their degrees on time. And that's probably why only about 40% of students who go to public four-year colleges have finished their degrees in 4 years. Parents, we're all fearful of that, right? Year five, year six, for them to get finished. And entire generations are being saddled with debt. There has not been a town hall meeting I've had in New Jersey or outside of New Jersey since the beginning of the year where someone hasn't raised the issue to me of student debt. It's an enormous problem. The debt lasts a lifetime. So for too many students, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They can go to college, struggle to get by, and face crippling debts when they get out, or they can forego college and face that loss of economic opportunity and mobility that we talked about before. So it's time we got to stop making college education a choice between the lesser of two hardships. If we want young people to continue aspiring towards a college education, and if we want students to have the means and the confidence to complete their programs, then we need to support them. And it's not just about making higher education free, as the president has suggested. That's a typical liberal approach to the problem, because we know there's nothing for free in this world. There are always costs involved, and if college graduates are going to reap the greater economic rewards and opportunities of earning a degree, it seems fair to me then for them to support the cost of the education they're receiving. Earning a degree should actually involve earning the degree. But for the neediest students, we can and we should do more. And that's where I think we should focus our efforts to make college more affordable. Over recent decades, there's been a steady increase in the amount of assistance available for middle-class students to earn a college degree. And in the last 10 years, Pell Grants have grown by 118%. Subsidized student loans have grown by 12%. Unsubsidized loans have grown by more than 150%. Certainly, there's more we can do to help middle-class students support themselves through college and to manage the burden of debt. And I'll discuss that in a moment. But first, let's discuss the situation facing students at the bottom of the economic ladder. Even while federal government spending for higher education has grown, the resources for poorer students have grown increasingly slimmer. Overall, students from families making less than $40,000 now receive a smaller portion of federal higher education aid than students from more well-off backgrounds over the last 10 years. The only federal student aid programs to be cut have been the ones for the neediest students in our society. The Federal Supplemental Education Opportunity Grant Program has shrunk by 20%. The Perkin Loans Program, one of the oldest and most valuable student programs for those with exceptional financial need, has declined by 54% over the last decade. Congress hasn't even made a new contribution to that program since President Bush's 2005 federal budget. If we believe in social mobility and economic empowerment for everyone, then we need to fix this. The poorest students deserve to go to college too. And they have a chance to receive the greatest boost from this. And they already face the greatest challenges. They're the least likely to go to college in the first place or to complete their degrees. So without delay, Congress should reconsider its spending priorities when it comes to higher ed and properly fund and expand student aid programs for the families at the bottom of the economic ladder. Everyone deserves a chance to climb that ladder. It's the right thing to do. We know it. And my father was one of those people at the bottom of the economic ladder, with a single mother and a father who died suddenly. There are other efforts we should consider when it comes to affordability for students from the middle class. One interesting proposal from Governor Branstad is for student debt reduction organization tax credits. This would give taxpayers, either individuals or companies, the option of donating to one of these organizations in exchange for a tax credit. Then the organization would be able to award grants to students in exchange for them completing some form of community service after they graduate. That seems like a win-win for students and for communities and for taxpayers, and it merits consideration not just in Iowa, but across America. See, ideas like this prove once again why Governor Branstad's been a leader in education in this country for over three decades. Affordability and innovation can go hand in hand, and proposals like this one can help us drive the conversation around affordability in a new direction. Another innovative approach could be the use of something called income share agreements. Now, this is a program where students agree to pay a percentage of their future income for a defined period of time in exchange for private financing. So they don't have a particular loan to pay off. But essentially, these folks, unlike traditional student loans, the amount a student pays depends on their own success. So this has a lot of potential benefits in my mind. With traditional private loans, students whose degrees don't pay off can wind up getting stuck with crippling repayments. But with an income share agreement, there's no lump sum to repay, so there's very strong downside protection for our students. Meanwhile, the investors in these programs have incredibly strong incentives to help students get a quality program that sets them up for long-term career success and to continue advising and guiding students after graduation. Income share agreements also have the potential to stem tuition inflation and to reward high quality but lower cost programs. Of course, it's all in the details. Anything like this would have to be structured so it's fair and it's effective for students. But we need to have a bigger national conversation about how to innovate on student financing. And options like this should be on the table for students who want to take advantage of it. This is one of my favorite topics now, about expanding our student financing options, but also making higher education more affordable, accessible, and transparent. Now, we need to help universities to run better and to introduce greater transparency and accountability and competition into this system. We need to do some things. We know there are so many extraordinary universities and leaders in higher ed out there, but we also know there are institutions out there which are less effective. And they don't always offer the students the academic value and the value for their money that we should demand. So today we see an increasing number of schools that aren't driven by the needs of the students, they're driven by tuition and fees. They aren't meeting their responsibility to be stewards of public resources. Some colleges, quite frankly, are drunk on cash, and they're embarking on crazy spending binges just because they know they can get huge revenues from tuition. We have $1 million-plus salaries for education administrators, and lots of them, and millions more being poured into unnecessary college bureaucracy. It's not a good system for students. It's not a sustainable system for anyone, because institutions that waste money like that aren't run well. Professor Clayton Christensen at Harvard Business School estimates, and think about this, up to 50% of U.S. colleges could go bankrupt in the next 10 to 15 years. 50%. Now, that's hopefully hyperbole, but it's no exaggeration that institutions are going to fail, and they're going to hurt students and their families in the process who've invested in them, because they aren't using their money responsibly today or planning for tomorrow. So here's some ideas how to fix this. First, colleges should provide greater transparency about how they're spending their money, both before and after someone decides to become a student there. Now think about it. If you're buying a house, there's a lot of data you can look at to decide if this is a wise investment. What kind of neighborhood is it? How will my future costs change? What's the school system like? But with a college degree, which is easily the other big expense in people's lives, we usually have much less information about a college is spending its money. People are told that degrees are worth an extra $1 million over the course of their life, so just trust us. We'll spend your money the right way. And when you become a student and you're charged for your tuition, you still don't get a whole lot of information, right, about how that money's actually being used. This drives me crazy. The college bill is the most opaque bill in the world. All right, I'm looking at parents and grandparents out there who probably paid this as I'm paying for two children in college right now. It's often just three lines, right? Tuition, room and board, other fees. Now, this is like if you went to a restaurant tonight here off campus, right? And six of you go out for dinner, and the bill comes at the end, and it says $120 for food. That's all it says, food, $120. Now, you wouldn't accept that check, right? You'd take that check back to the waiter or waitress and say, hey, I'd like to know what each one of these items cost that we ate tonight, and how much did the wine cost that we ordered, and all the rest. I need to have that on there. Now, you wouldn't accept that for a $120 dinner bill. But for a $60,000 college bill, we say, hey, okay, no problem. Where do I sign? Let's write the check. It makes no sense. I just recently got a letter from the University of Notre Dame where my oldest daughter will be a sophomore next year. And the letter's wonderful, right? The first paragraph is great. You know, 'cause it's from Notre Dame. Right? So here it is. It's like, we thank you so much for the blessing of sending your child and entrusting their souls at our university for the next 4 years, right? I mean, you can hear the music from Rudy playing in the background. You'd hear it. You see the Golden Dome in your mind's eye, touchdown Jesus, the whole thing. And then Father Jenkins comes in for the kill, right? Second paragraph is, and so we're pleased to tell you that our tuition increase this year will be only 3.9%. Now, remember that inflation is 1.5%. 3.9%. Here's the kicker, though, which is the lowest annual tuition increase at Notre Dame in the last 40 years. So that total student cost for next year is $61,750. Thank you so much. Listen, this is pretty simple. People should be able to know in advance how colleges are spending our money, where their resources are going, and how they expect prices to change in the future. And let me stop here for a second again. I brought my daughter to a town hall meeting in New Hampshire about 3 weeks ago, the one who goes to Notre Dame. And I was talking about this point in the town hall meeting, and I was trying to make what I thought was a ridiculous point. But I'll see if it's ridiculous at Iowa State. I said to one person, I said, you know, listen, what if you knew they broke out the tuition bill and they told you that 2% of your tuition costs this year were going to build a rock climbing wall on campus? My daughter piped up in the front row and she said, we already have a rock climbing wall. You have a rock climbing wall here?
Yeah.
Damn, man. Driving parents crazy everywhere. After students are enrolled in college, they should be able to see a cost itemization for their tuition. And they should know what all of us are paying for and what they're incurring debt for. If we could break out those costs, I think we should also unbundle them. Here's what I mean. Let's allow students to just pay for the education and not all the add-ons. So there's huge value, obviously, in students getting a full college experience, like the rock climbing wall. But for students from low-income backgrounds, those extra costs can mean the difference between going to college and not going to college. So we have a big opportunity here to make a difference in affordability, too. Let's let them pay for what they want to pay for. And that'll also be a market test, everybody, because if everybody decides not to pay for the rock climbing wall, maybe the university gets the idea we really don't need to build the rock climbing wall. In the end, it's about empowering consumers. It's about people giving the chance to vote with their feet by deciding which colleges to attend, based on whether they're using the money wisely and providing a great education. And by shining a light on wasteful spending, we can make colleges more disciplined. So we should demand transparency from every educational institution. And here's the kicker. The president and the Congress should make this a requirement for participating in federal grant and loan programs. If you're unwilling to show us what we're paying for and permit us to pay for the education we want, then we should prohibit those institutions from taxpayer-funded programs. It's simple fairness and it's common sense. So once we have that transparency, we should work with institutions to help them run leaner and smarter. Part of that will come just from schools being able to analyze and compare their operating costs with other similar institutions. Sharing data is already something that will be transformative for these places. But we can also do more to help institutions to manage their assets and their facilities in more efficient ways. One obvious thing we should be doing is encouraging schools to look at programs with low levels of graduation and to see if that's because of a lack of quality or a lack of interest from students. Failing programs should be cut, and the resources should be taken and used elsewhere. Lots of schools have exorbitant operating and maintenance costs because they're not optimizing the way they use their physical space. They hold all the classes during peak hours because that's when the unions want the professors to teach. And so they need to build more facilities, because if you're only going to teach between Tuesday and Thursday from like 10 a.m. to 3 o'clock, you need more facilities during that period of time, but they lay empty lots of the other times. It's not even helpful for a lot of students who want to be able to combine studying with work. Wouldn't it be more sensible to offer more evening classes, more weekend classes? Shouldn't we offer more classes on Fridays? In New Jersey, Kane University has been offering students a 20% discount in their tuition for courses if they take them on Friday and Saturday. At the University of Iowa, departments have been directed to schedule more classes on Fridays. These are sensible steps that can help institutions cater to more students without driving up capital and operating costs. And we should encourage every institution to think about incorporating these type of steps in what they do. Now it brings me to the final piece of the puzzle. We just need to be more imaginative about what higher education can look like. We shouldn't fear to think about alternatives to the traditional four-year university. I'm a graduate of a traditional four-year public university, the University of Delaware. I had a great experience there and got a great education there. But the world is changing, and education ought to change with it. We should give students lots of different options about their ways to learn, as long as they're getting valuable preparation for the things that they want to accomplish in their lives. Higher education, as I said at the top, should be for everyone. But that doesn't mean there's a single model for everyone. It makes no sense. There really are some valuable options that people should be offered that we're not offering now. Right now, we encourage students to focus on earning one four-year degree and to get all the training they need in a single burst, 4, 5, 6 years, however long it takes. Increasingly, students want the flexibility to jump in and out of education as needed, to follow jobs and opportunities during college when they need to, or to return to college later for additional training as they require new skills. We should work to create stackable credits so that students can re-enroll at different colleges without losing their credits that they've earned before. That's going to make learning more efficient, more affordable, and more responsive to the changing needs of our business community, who hopefully will employ them. We should also give people other ways to get the skills and earn the credentials they need. We should consider ways to extend the use of apprenticeships and to make them more attractive for young people and employers. Learning on the job is still learning. And for many professions, it's the most valuable way to learn. So we should provide tax incentives to cover the cost of apprentice wages and program costs. Students in every state should also have the option to get some sort of on-the-job training before finishing high school. And this is something we've already done in New Jersey. There are high schools where students can earn certifications in welding through a partnership with the American Welding Society, train to use Oracle databases, or become technology specialists certified by Microsoft. These are all meaningful education options that can help students to choose their path after high school. We should invest more in offering high-quality professional training opportunities in New Jersey and in Iowa. Employers work with community colleges to bring skill training programs onto their sites. For example, students at Iowa Central Community College can complete their degrees while also getting on-the-job experience at Cargill. Linking employers with skill development programs like this seems like a really good model, and it's something we shouldn't just be offering through community colleges, but through private and for-profit institutions as well. And if more companies and organizations want to step up and provide valuable training courses, then we should get the Department of Education bureaucrats off their backs and rein in some of these crazy regulations that have been placed on educators. Right now, a lot of state and federal regulations make it really difficult to offer training programs that can evolve to keep up with the needs of the labor market. If you want to get access to federal aid for a program, then you have to be an accredited provider. And to do that, you have to grant degrees. In many states, if you change your curriculum, you have to ask for permission again. Mother, may I? And if you provide online training, then you have to be approved in every state individually. None of that makes sense to me. And we should get rid of these regulations holding back innovation and holding back people from getting the skills they need to be employed. And if people have the right skills and knowledge, then they should be able to earn some type of credential. We should have an option for certifying students based on prior learning. Professional or military experience provides this as well, and participation in some of the training programs I talked about, allowing them to ultimately earn certification or complete a sub-baccalaureate program of study. We've done this in New Jersey with returning veterans, and it has been wildly successful. Research by the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce predicts that by 2020, 30% of jobs will require less than a bachelor's degree, but more than a high school degree. Why not allow people just to get the qualifications they need to get the job that they want? Not the one we think they should get, but the one they want. Of course, if students do decide later to go on to college, then they should be able to get credit for the knowledge they've earned outside the classroom. I know the colleges don't want to do that because they don't get paid for it. But, you know, we've done that in New Jersey, too, with a program called the New Jersey Plan Program. This allows students to earn credits towards their degrees through prior learning assessments. So we've shortened the time students need to be in the classroom. We've lowered their costs. We've expanded qualifications to more hardworking young people. And that's really all I can think that you can ask of in a program. Everybody's going to get their education in the way that works best for them if we let them. And if we don't, they'll abandon it. And we know the effect that has on them, both in terms of their ability to earn a living and support a family. We want everybody earning a living that we possibly can. So that's how I see the opportunities ahead for us in education reform as a country. We face a lot of big challenges in the years ahead, and we need to do more to improve the quality of K-12 education. We need to speak out and stand up to the entrenched educational interests, and we also need to make higher education more affordable and accessible. We need to improve the way our institutions operate and to provide meaningful alternatives to a four-year traditional degree. I think we made a lot of progress in New Jersey, and there are things that we've achieved that can be an inspiration, a model for reformers in other states and at the national level. But education reform is a much bigger conversation that we need to now have as a country. So this is something I'm looking forward to being a part of in the months and the years ahead. One thing you should be clear about is this. There might not be any simple solutions to education reform, but there are solutions, and I think I've just laid out a number of them. But what we should remember is this. America cannot be a middle-of-the-pack country in math and science today and expect to be the world's number one economic and military power for the 21st century. And that is where we're headed, without a real change of course. We have to face some hard and uncomfortable truths, and we have to force our country to fix the shortcomings we have in our education system. We need to do it now. We've delayed already too long. Every day we wait, we are wasting the God-given potential of another child. And that, in my view, is immoral. We can achieve extraordinary things when we dare to innovate and when we challenge the status quo. If we fight the purveyors of the attitude that we've always done it this way, we give our children a fighting chance in this new world. Let's remember, we're Americans. We came from everywhere in the world to create a new world. We didn't have a blueprint for how to build a country, but we did it. And we did it so well that we've gotten the opportunity to lead the world. We did it because we opened our minds, and we also opened the books. We learned the ways of the world, and we learned how to improve ourselves. And for every young person who chose to study, they made their life better and the life for everyone who they came in contact with. Today, there are too many young people being left behind, and that's not worthy. It is not worthy of a great nation. So we need to go and get them and to give them every chance we can at greatness. That's what this country guarantees. It doesn't guarantee greatness. It guarantees a chance at greatness. That's what we need to provide these young people. And the longer we wait, the more lives and potential that slips through our fingers. Our country's future is at stake on this issue. That's why I came here to talk about it today. So let's act together, and let's act now to prepare a new generation to head out into the world. It's an exciting thing. Let's give our young people the strength to build a new American century, and let's win the future. The time to do this is now. We've talked enough about it. We can't wait any longer, because our young people's lives, to each and every one of us, is a precious gift from God. And we need to start treating it that way. And standing up to the self-interested parties who stand in the way of reform and change that we know makes common sense is a moral obligation for each and every one of us, in addition to a personal obligation to our own children and our own grandchildren. So I hope you believe, as I do, that the time for reforming our country's education system is now. And I really appreciate you giving me the time to come to Iowa State today to talk about it. Thank you all very much.